Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to another bonus episode of the Tech Meme Ride Home. I'm Brian McCullough. Super thrilled about this one because for years, Jay Yarrow and Farhad Manju had a podcast, The Jay and Farhad Show. You might remember Jay Yarrow from his time at Business Insider, but of course now he's an executive editor at CNBC, now a big deal. And Farhad, of course, has always been a big deal, New York Times tech columnist. Well, the boys stopped doing their podcast late last year, which was a super bummer for a lot of us. Jay and Farhad had a super cool chemistry, and I know a lot of people for whom the show was unmissable. Well, I got Jay and Farhad to put the band back together, so you're about to hear a special reunion episode of the Jay and Farhad Show, and believe me, you're going to get a taste of that special chemistry. But first,
let's be real for a minute. Most guys would wear a t-shirt every day of their lives if they could. The problem is that most t-shirts are not acceptable to wear at work or out on a hot date night. But today's sponsor, Cuts, has finally changed that. Cuts t-shirts are such high quality, wrinkle-free, and so buttery soft that you can look like you're dressing up even when you're dressing down. Yeah, you heard that. Wrinkle-free. You never have to substitute comfort for fashion ever again. If you see me in a t-shirt, it's likely one from Cuts. I'm also a huge fan of their AO five-pocket pants, the right sort of step-up from jeans without going all the way into dress pants, like literally my ideal Venn diagram of professional-looking but comfortable feeling. When you touch something from Cuts, you can immediately feel the quality. Their proprietary fabric blends are ridiculously soft and breathable, they don't wrinkle, and they look way more expensive than they actually are. For a limited time, our listeners get 20% off your entire order when you use code RIDE at checkout. That's 20% off your order at cutsclothing.com with promo code RIDE. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the perfect blend of style and comfort with Cuts Clothing. cutsclothing.com, promo code RIDE for 20% off. Whenever I need to do financial research for this show, for instance, during tech earnings season when I have to analyze how various companies' stocks have been performing, I only ever turn to our sponsor today, Yahoo Finance. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They are the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. With a community of over 90 million users each month, their real strength is helping you on your way to financial success. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Okay, back together again like a classic indie rock band from the 90s, Jay Yarrow and Farhad Manju. How about just for old time's sake, sure. Why don't you do the honors with the intro?
Hello!
No, do it again. I spoke over you.
Okay. Hello! It's the Jay and Farhad Show reunion. I'm Jay Yarrow, executive editor at CNBC. You are?
I'm Farhad Manju, and we are back. Actually, we're not back. We're just doing a special.
Well, you can't imagine, Jay, how many times I've been tempted to open with a hello, but I figure that that's yours and everyone would know it, and I'm not going to step on
it. Oh, it's okay. I think I stole it from Henry Blodgett's Twitter bio. I think Henry Blodgett's Twitter bio,
if you look at it,
I think it says, "Hello, I'm the CEO of Business Insider," something like that, which I always found like amusing that it said hello. So I'm pretty sure that's what it was inspired by.
Well, let's get this out of the way first.
Wither the Jay and Farhad show. Is it dead? Is it just resting? What's going on?
It's like resting. It's you can't kill something that was never alive, right? So
So what happened? So I loved doing this show because it's just me and Jay talking, and Jay's fun to talk to, and we didn't do any preparation. The problem is, like, scheduling is hard. Like, we live on different coasts, and we would always try to get someone else on. So then you have three people trying to get on, and like Jay's job got kind of busier, and my job got busy for a while. I don't know. And I have two kids, and no one's busier than someone with two kids, as Jay knows, I think. So we just like never found time, and it wasn't like no one's paying us for this.
Right.
It's not affiliated with the Times or CNBC. It's just like us talking. So, and then Jay didn't want to pay for the SoundCloud account, so that was the
Well, that's, I mean, it was more you kept, like, you were also Farhad was writing his book, so, like, that kind of took time away from doing it, and there was, you know, like, I'm executive editor of CNBC, like, we, you know, when we started doing
Ooh,
it, like,
fancy titles.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, when we started doing it, Farhad was a technology columnist, and I was, like, a tech editor/reporter, and things had changed for both of us. But bottom line is, it's not like it was a hobby. It was right. And is a hobby for us. And so, you know, it came and went. And like between like with Farhad doing his book, he could never make it to do the thing. And then, yeah, so that's just sort of how it went to the side. It's not like it's not dead. It's just we've tried here and there and it just hasn't worked out.
Well, that does explain why the archives are offline. But by the way, guys, I know of a ton of free hosting podcast hosting companies. That you could throw that back up
yeah,
on.
But we'd have to like Google for that and then you know
no you
forms
could you
and...
could ask Brian and Brian would tell you.
Okay.
Now number one, also by the way, you have tons of fans. The amount of times that people have mentioned your show in passing, you know, and just in conversation, like and I told you guys a million times on Twitter, number one, the only thing that makes podcasts work is having interesting people on and people that have something interesting to say. So you guys had that. And then number two, the magic that you guys hit upon and a lot of people don't is that you can't have two hosts that generally agree most of the time. And so like I told you guys on Twitter, like the best shows were when mommy and daddy would fight.
Yeah.
Because generally you guys came at most issues in slightly different directions. So it was great.
I think we managed to do, I think like the key to all those kinds of things is that you generally agree, you just make it seem like you don't agree, you just agree differently. Like, I guess that's not true. Farhad is like the most conventional thing I've ever encountered. So, maybe we don't always agree, but we certainly appeared that way. I would always get comments on Twitter that I sucked, which I gotta say, that kind of hurt. But, you know, I don't disagree.
I actually disagree. You don't suck. I think that a lot of times I was just not paying attention to the stuff you were saying, and you were sort of like really carrying the show. You know, for that I thank you. But you know, the Twitter people, they could have a point. You may suck. I don't know.
No, I wouldn't argue. And like, it's very by the way, very very kind of you to say all that stuff.
I just mean I was looking at Twitter
not you.
While you were speaking.
I didn't mean you. I meant Brian. But you know, it's funny that. We would get occasional tweets. We would get occasional inquiries. Hey, where's the podcast? And I did a podcast before this a long time ago. We did it at when that was Business Insiders, like Silicon Alley Insider. It was like with Dan Frommer and Nick Carlson. And we stopped doing that. But we'd get comments. There's something about podcasts that is like, it's obviously an intimate thing. You're speaking, you're in someone's ears. It's usually, you don't really listen to podcasts with other people. It's just, you're usually solo. So it's very flattering when people ask, and it's very kind because I stopped writing and nobody said, hey, only one person, Eric Jackson, said, I wish you still wrote. Nobody's ever done that, but stop doing the podcast and I get some of that.
I get comments about it all the time. I mean, even when we were doing it, people would say they're fans of it. It was sort of like, I mean, I think it's the thing about podcasts is you create this very intimate relationship with the hosts. And I feel that way about podcasts I listen to. So I can imagine that it hurts some people deeply to not hear me every week. So,
well, to try to give people a taste of the magic that they're missing, let's kick off. I'm going to ask you to pick your poison. Apple or Facebook, or maybe even Apple versus Facebook. What do you guys wish that you had the podcast to talk about over the last week or two?
I don't know. You know how we used to do it? Was we, like, in the sort of end, we used to just look at Tech Meme and see what was popular on Tech Meme.
we spend time making fun of Tech Meme.
We would just make
fun of Tech Meme. But I love Gabe. I love Tech Meme. But how about this? Here's the angle that I would say. Here's the angle I've been thinking about, particularly after Facebook. What exactly is the scandal with Facebook? I know, like, everyone says they've been scandal plagued. Can you, like, Farhad, tell me, what's the scandal with Facebook that's happened this year? Like, what's the thing?
Not this year, Cambridge Analytica, which was like several years ago, but basically...
And what was the Cambridge Analytica story?
It was giving friends of your friends, giving this research company access to basically all your data without a
right,
lot
which
of...
Which happened how many years ago? Like 5 years ago, and then they turned it off, right?
Right, they turned it off, although they didn't get the data back.
Yeah, but...
So, like, and then they... And then... the other things, the entire Russian influence operation, although we don't really know. I mean, I think there's just sort of very little evidence that sort of made a difference in the election. But it obviously sort of added to this like social concern about Facebook's power in the news and Facebook's sort of like just the rise of misinformation and the spread of misinformation and its role in the 2016 election. I think that was like the scandal, the main scandal of Facebook. Also, there's all the ad metric stuff, you know, like basically fake numbers for in several different ways.
Well, the problem on the ad metrics thing is, to me, I feel like advertisers and clients are... They have a way of measuring, like, I don't think most clients today are measuring just like impressions of an advertisement. Like they have an outcome, like they kind of try to tie back to see is something happening on the other side of our marketing dollars, particularly for digital. So
you don't think the numbers, I mean, that was the whole promise of digital media. Like we would know. And then the kind of the ad metric stuff at Facebook kind of undercut that whole argument. The other is all those discriminatory ad selling practices that ProPublica pointed out, you know, like we want to block certain races or religions or advertise to, you know, Nazis or whatever. there's one of those. What else? There's...
Listen, just this week, I was... The one that put me over the edge was the kids being able to spend their parents' money playing Angry Birds on Facebook, and they knew that, and they designed it to be that way.
Right.
Wait, what is that? One. What was it? Say, I missed that one.
This is why you should listen to the Tech Meme Ride Home, Jay.
Obviously.
Yeah, long story short, they essentially... kids were racking up like $5,000 playing games because, you know, you'd have these in-app purchases. Uh-huh. The kids had no idea that the accounts were tied to their parents' credit card account. There's all these eternal documents that came out that allegedly Facebook knew about this and called it friendly fraud, in quotes, and blah, blah, blah.
I guess for me, another scandal is copying or... Completely, yeah, just decimating Snapchat, copying stories.
That's a scandal?
I mean, I think it's unfair and monopolistic. Wait, but is your argument that there's no scandal?
No, I mean, my argument is just like when you're coming into this earnings report and it's like, you know, all this, like Facebook has had this like huge negative perception hanging over it all year. And then I'm trying to think, like, if I zoom back and think about, like, okay, as a user, what am I really outraged about with Facebook? Like, what is it that...
the addiction stuff? Like, they even published research, Facebook did, about how just, like, mindlessly scrolling on Facebook is, like, bad for your health in several ways. So there was that, too.
It's bad for you. It's, you know... I think that's like the people have free will. They make that choice. Like, it's bad for your health. It's not cigarettes bad for your health.
I'm just saying that there's not, like, so yesterday they released earnings that suggested that people are still, like, really on Facebook. And advertisers love Facebook. And, like, Facebook is doing really well. I guess I was, like, minimally surprised because they did have, especially in North America, they'd had, like, flat numbers for several quarters. It looked like they were declining. They even sort of suggested that they would try to that like they expected declining engagement. And so it was a little bit surprising, but you know, I don't think I mean, it's an addictive product. Like, it's not that surprising that people are.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that, like, I'm just trying to think about the perspective of your average Facebook user. What has Facebook done in the past 3, 6, or 12 months that would make you say, I can't do this anymore. I can't.
I think the major story is they, you know, it's the same story. Like, they have and continue to play fast and loose with people's private information, and it's unclear how they house it. And but the other thing about the Facebook privacy story is that, like, it never has seemed to affect you know, people's willingness to use Facebook. Like, and so maybe again we're seeing that that's happening. Like, this is just sort of the latest iteration of, like, Facebook's kind of loop of scandal where it's like privacy outrage.
But what's the privacy, like, what's the, like, the Cambridge Analytica thing was many years old. What's, like, what's a privacy outrage in all the things you are listing?
No, I mean, I think the Cambridge Analytica thing was many years old, but we learned about it and the scope of it more recently. I feel like that was the thing.
Farhad mentioned fast and loose. What do you guys think about, you know, playing fast and loose with Apple's rules of the road in terms of using their certificates and things like that?
I guess that didn't bother me that much.
Well, in fact, I'm kind of shifting gears a bit. Not does that bother you as a user, but maybe I'm thinking more in terms of just the general Facebook attitude of, you know, we're invincible, we can do whatever we want, like, even to the point of we're going to poke Apple in the eye.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I think that it suggests something about their internal culture, which I think is, like, the right target here. I don't know if invincibility is the right word, but they just seem to have no kind of internal, like, barriers against doing things that might be good for their business. There's no, like, internal kind of stops or ethics or just, like, questions about, like, how will this look if the New York Times reported it in detail, or, like, TechCrunch in this case.
If I'm in the meeting, if I'm, like, Mark Zuckerberg or I'm Sheryl Sandberg, and, you know, one of my directs or whatever comes up and says, hey, we want to do some market research. And what our plan is we're going to offer people $20 a month. So, you know, not that much money, $240 a year. And they're going to give us full access to their devices. And we say, okay, well, what's the age range we're looking at? And let's say whatever it was, 13 to 45 or whatever it was. We say, okay, well, on those teenagers, we're going to make sure that they can sign off, right? And, like, we don't want to do anything untoward. Yeah, no, of course, they're going to sign off. I'd be like, okay, yeah, if people are willing to let for
yeah, but is it
bucks,
the problem here that they, like, Apple didn't allow that? Like, that wasn't, I mean, it's
right,
sort of.
I don't know the specifics of why they decided to go the route they did. And, like, I also, like, why does Apple get to decide whether or not, like, it's my phone.
Well, that's the interesting thing, right?
It's my phone, and I want to give anyone, if someone's willing to pay me $20 a month to get to just see what I'm doing, in essence, I give it to Apple for free. So, sure, I'll give you $20.
That's a good argument.
There's two things here also, like, you know, people have made the argument just today that, like, you know, this shows actually the scary power of Apple. The thing is, the question that I have is, so we're all assuming that Apple has, because it's the platform, like I said on yesterday's show, you know, Zuckerberg wanted his own Facebook phone so he could have this information. He never got it. So he tried to do an end round to get it. So how do we know? We're all assuming that Apple doesn't do anything with this data, right?
I don't know if we're assuming. I mean, I think Apple says that it doesn't collect this sort of data.
I think what I'm saying is that Apple gives off the impression that we're a neutral broker, we're the platform, we're in the hardware business. We're not going to look at your business of your apps.
I mean, that's just false. Like, they have a huge problem perception-wise, which is, like, Google pays them $9 billion a year to get the search box, and everything you type in there goes to Google, and whatever, and it also turned out that Google had a similar privacy infringing app. But, like, whatever sort of position, whatever kind of holy privacy position Apple is taking is totally undercut by its Google deal. And I feel like if it really wanted to kind of make this point that it's going to try to fight the internet advertising business, try to reform the kind of privacy of that whole business, it should make DuckDuckGo the default search engine. Like, it should do something different about the search engine. It should change the way that it operates with companies like Facebook and Google, you know, in all kinds of ways. I suspect that one reason Facebook felt okay doing that is because, like, Apple may not have been enforcing such rules, like obviously wasn't enforcing such rules. And like the culture of Apple with regard to what people can do on those, you know, sideloaded apps maybe wasn't clear. And maybe Apple, you know, was sort of winkingly okay with that kind of stuff. We don't know what signs Apple gave Facebook that, you know, that would have been okay.
Jay, do you have any thoughts about Apple and peak smartphone and smartphone recession and that sort of thing?
Sure.
Sounds like no.
here's what I would say on Apple. I mean, like, you know, Apple's an unbelievable business, just an unbelievably great business. Like, in its bad quarters, it's doing $84 billion in revenue or whatever. It's just an awesome, awesome business. You know, they weren't going to sell iPhones forever, and they suffer, if you want to call it that, by tough comparisons. And I think the Apple Watch is an amazing business. It doesn't get credit that it deserves for probably being an amazing business. Part of that is because Apple decided not to release unit numbers, so nobody knew, which allows Apple to have this market essentially to itself. But at the same time, it doesn't probably get credit as a result of it. The thing that I'm going to be watching and I'm interested to see how it goes is like Apple's whole like services narrative and obsession. I think that could be dangerous for Apple because
why?
Well, because in order to drive services, it's essentially an upselling business. It's you bought this expensive phone. Now we want you to upsell you into Apple Care, and we want to upsell you into iCloud storage, and we want to upsell you into Apple Music, and we want to like tack on a lot of stuff. And I think that can, you know, it has some risk for a user to be like, gosh, why are they trying to constantly like ping me to upsell me on things? And I think that's the risk there.
No, well, so here's what I think. I mean, I've heard several people suggest this, so I don't know who to give credit to, but there's this idea floating around sort of like Apple, the like Apple community, Apple fandom, and some analysts that Apple would, you know, turn over its model into something like the Amazon Prime model, where you'd pay, I don't know, like some hundreds, like $1,000 or more a year to get it, or, you know, every 2 years to get like a phone, access to their music and TV service.
Oh, like Apple Prime, is what you're saying?
Apple Care, yeah. You'd get the hardware and the services together.
I think I floated this years ago on our podcast, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's you.
Probably.
I think that's a good idea. That's like turning services into this like recurring subscription. And, you know, I think their long-term bet is on like rich people. There are going to be like continue to be rich people in the world. And like, you know, if you're a company betting on like inequality, you're doing going to do well. I think their huge problem is in China. Ben Thompson has written about this often. It's like they don't have a good kind of differentiator in China because like everyone uses WeChat. And so you can move like WeChat is sort of the thing you think about when you use your phone, and it's the difference between an Android phone and an Apple phone in that environment, you know, is smaller. That's reasonable to me. That makes sense. I don't know exactly how Apple solves that. You know, they're smart about software. Maybe they can figure something out. Maybe they just sort of continue to decline in China, but elsewhere, I don't see their dominance sort of declining. And like, their hardware to me still seems much better than everyone else's. Like, I have been using the 10S Max, I guess it's called, and I love it. It's great. The camera's great. Big fan.
Yeah, so. I mean, sure.
Okay, before we go, Farhad, you had your piece this week about the woes in digital media. Extremely well written, which everyone said.
Extremely? Extremely well written?
Listen,
even
reread
Henry
it, Jay. I was just going to say, so even Henry...
Well, it was okay.
Henry Blodgett
Henry
pointed
said
out
a great writer.
Henry that, was just Henry was saying that because he was about to slam you, so he was trying to, like, butter you up before he trashed you.
So Henry did take umbrage with it. So first, just, you know, recap sort of what you were trying to say in that piece, and then I imagine Jay maybe will be taking Henry's role by proxy here.
It just seems to me like a time of the, like the end of the kind of optimistic, innovative boom time of digital media, and that's sad to me. We had this idea that, like, it's been good that in the last couple years, subscriptions are doing really well at the Times, at some other publications,
won't even name them.
And then there's a bunch of billionaires who are helping people, helping media, buying media, you know, Bezos and others. But I don't think that that's the model for, like, the world. I mean, not everyone can pay a lot. Most people won't pay. And it doesn't seem to be making a dent in, like, local news. And there was this promise with BuzzFeed and a whole bunch of other companies that kind of grew up around the same time that took VC money, that you could build a thriving free media business kind of alongside social media. Social media would be the distribution, and you could still make ad money doing it, and you could, you know, support a newsroom of hundreds. And I think the BuzzFeed layoffs really suggest the end of that kind of hope. Like, BuzzFeed is still going to continue, but I think it'll be smaller, less innovative, less experimental. It's going to have a far fewer journalists. Like, journalism is sort of like... you know, it's just like a branding thing for them. It helps their brand. I don't think they're going to make a lot of money from it. And this, to me, is very sad. Maybe it's expected. Like, I think that the thing Henry was saying was that, you know, the business expanded too quickly, and, like, it'll get smaller but not die. But even smaller and not dying is still bad. So, yeah.
So I would say you're entitled to be sad. You can, yeah, I'm not going to stop you from being sad, but I think it's like there's just this over, like, not to be too much of a cliche, like, local news is a legitimate problem that I don't think anyone has solved for or figured out. But I do think that, I mean, my personal view on local news in terms of solving for local news is that you have one, maybe three, like, I mean, local, like, at your town level. You get like 1 to 5 like killer reporters who build like a newsletter that I think people in town would pay for, and you could probably do well.
I think that could work.
Yeah, you know, like it's someone like a great reporter who can sniff out information in your town and just like almost like the town gossip who knows everything. But you know, whatever, local, state, now state issues, like covering like state government. I think that that's probably, I'm not super smart on this, but it does seem like it's going to be a problem. It certainly seems like it. But the other, like, to the bigger point, I totally side with Henry on this. Like, look, BuzzFeed is a $300 million on revenue business. That's a great business. That's a really good business. Now, what's the problem, quote unquote, for BuzzFeed? Well, they raised money. They raised a ton, like $400 million. Yeah. They raised, like, I don't know, I think $500 million over the course of their lifespan or whatever. And they raised it at like a $1.3 billion valuation, which means the people who invested, which is like the parent company of CNBC, NBC Universal, they invested at over $1 billion valuation, I believe, which means they thought that would probably be worth $3 billion in like a 10-year span or 5-year span, which is how that kind of investment usually works. And maybe it's not going to be worth $3 billion in the next 2 years or 5 years. That doesn't mean it's a bad business. That doesn't mean that it's a bad company. It just means that it's not going to fulfill the expectations that were thrust upon it, or that it thrust upon itself a few years ago. And maybe, you know, I don't know the inner workings of BuzzFeed, you know, but maybe they were hiring. They had this view of like, let's hire like crazy. We're okay burning cash because we're going to grow the top line, and eventually we're going to figure out a really great business and we're going to have margin expansion. And that never happened, or that hasn't yet happened. And so now they're in a position where, like, okay, we've built a really good business, and now we need to figure out how to get profitable and be sustainable. And that means like you're going to have to make some hard choices, and you're going to make some cuts in some journalistic parts of what you're doing. But that's sort of like natural, and that's how it happens in business. Like, you just can't just hire recklessly and expect everything to work out. Like, that's running a business.
I don't think that's exactly right. I don't think they hired it recklessly. I think they had a view of the internet that suggested that as the social web sort of recognized the quality of their content, that they would get higher ad rates than like user generated content would. And that didn't really happen. Like, what happened right. is that, but
that's okay. Like the New York Times, to Henry's point, like the New York Times, despite you being there, has been really flourishing lately. And so has the Washington Post, and they're profitable businesses. Politico is a profitable business. Axios is a great example. Like, here's another great example. Axios launched, they say, we have to take their word for it because they're private.
Axios is not making money.
Axios did $25 million in revenue in its second year and lost $56,000. If Axios wanted to turn a profit, it would do it tomorrow. It would just either like let one person go, sorry to whoever you are, or it would just hire one less person this year. Like, it could make money. Now, are you looking for, like, this gets into something I've been thinking about a lot, is how Facebook just totally, I think Facebook scrambled everyone's brains. Like, Facebook was this just Google was an unbelievable business, like a magic money machine. Literally, people go into Google and ask for things to buy. And so the ads are served to them. It's just unbelievable. Huge cash, like a cash machine, just this unbelievable business. And if Google existed alone, everyone would be like, well, that's Google. They're just freaks of nature. There's one of them. But then Facebook came along and Facebook did it. And so then what happened was everyone's like, oh, my God, like these aren't. Google wasn't a freak of nature. There's more than one Google. So it was like Facebook. So then all these like expectations were heaped upon Twitter and Pinterest and everyone else, because it was like, well, Facebook proved there's got to be more than one. So there's probably five of them out there. And then it turns out there's probably only two. And, you know, some of this happened in media too, where it's like, you're like, oh, Axios, they're not making money. It's like, okay, like, is Axios going to be a $100 billion company that's like doing a 50% margin? Probably not. Like, what's the natural margin on that business? I don't know. Like, maybe it's 20, maybe it's 30%. What's the natural size for the revenue?
But also,
they're in year two. Like, maybe it's 100 million, maybe it's 50 million. But let's say you built a media business that generated 50 million in revenue and you were able to pocket $10 to $20 million. Would you be happy with that? Like, if you built that business and you worked at that company and you were doing high quality journalism? Like, yeah.
Not to pimp my own stuff, but like, this is what I was talking about last weekend with Rafat Ali. This whole concept of, it's not just that, everyone, can we do another Google? Can we do another Facebook? It was also that I think that VCs and everybody else thought that you could have a media business that could achieve the scale of a Facebook, where you could have a publication that was read by a billion people every single day. And that's sort of what the dream that like the BuzzFeeds of the world sold people on. And that's right. The thing that seems to have been ephemeral.
Sure.
Right. And I think that like Axios Axios might do well in the same way that Politico did well, which is like they were founded by the same people. It's sort of a niche publication for a group, for some types of readers, media junkies in Axios's case.
Axios would say political and business leaders.
All right. Whatever. Okay. I like Axios. Axios. But I don't think that it's an example of what I think BuzzFeed was trying to go for and what I think we're missing, which is like some digital newsroom on the scale of like the New York Times or the Washington Post that can be sustainable on advertising, like a thing that serves like the country or the world or Europe or something. I don't think we're seeing that. What we're seeing is like the New York Times kind of surviving, the Washington Post surviving, and then like,
Yeah, but so like what, like that's like, who that says was, there have to be a thousand different companies? Like, it wasn't like, it's like there was BuzzFeed, there was Vox, there's Huffington Post, there's Business Insider. Like, that's four. Like, how many do you think, how many do you need? News is a commodity. Like, it's a commodity business, right?
Yeah. I mean,
so
it's
why
not,
should there
not,
be a ton of those?
You're saying it's going to be smaller and I should be okay with that. I'm just saying like I'm not okay with that. I thought the internet was going to give us I thought that it the sort of dream of the last few years was that we would have perhaps like a thriving news industry, like the gloom of the end of like newspapers.
Thriving news industry, though. Like we have a thriving news industry.
We have a thriving news industry built on business models that are, you know, pretty shaky and dependent on platforms to kind of, for like.
Every business is shaky. Like we just like.
Apple's isn't. Google's isn't. You just said
oh,
that.
Really? Apple just lost $300 billion in market cap in the past 3 months.
Oh, but that you. That, their business
okay.
Is not shaky.
So it's not hard. Go ask Tim Cook if he thinks that people out there just like take their hats off to Apple and don't have criticism of it and don't think it's a shaky business. Like every business has haters and critics, and like in the media business is the same thing. And like there was this weird like entitlement feeling, I guess, in the media business that everything should work and everything will be fine. Like, you know, these are like the New York Times is a good business. It is. It's not like, you know, it's not Facebook and it's not Google and it's not making iPhones. So, but guess what? Those are three of the greatest businesses in the world. So maybe don't compare yourself to them. Like, it's all about, to me, managing costs and managing expectations. Like, manage your costs, manage how big you think you're really going to be okay, and understand that and be okay with it.
Right. Like, I don't
do you think like, do you think that journalism is bad right now? I think journalism's great right now.
In general, I think that journalism is great right now, but it's going to be worse after the layoffs of last week. It's going to be worse after when there's a recession. Like it's going to like we're in good times economically, and we're having layoffs in digital media. I think that there's
layoffs in everything. Like every industry goes through churn. Like there's layoffs in all kinds of businesses.
I'm not suggesting that this is like that this should be some easy churn-free business. There's always been churn in this business, but I think, you know, I think winter is coming. I think it's going to get worse.
Okay, guys, that's mm-hmm. what I wanted. Okay. As the biggest Jay and Farhad stan maybe out there, that's that old time rock and roll. Thank you guys both for coming on the show. If we ever do this again, we'll have to do it at a time when I have more time to just let you guys go.
Yeah, we didn't even get to talk about our favorite topic, which is Tesla. So.
Oh no, I thought that was Twitter.
Yeah, I thought Twitter was our favorite topic.
I feel like we talk about Tesla basically every week.
Yeah, well, Tesla's interesting. I mean, but you've quit Twitter, which is crazy. It's your whole identity. You must feel lost without it.
I feel okay. It is my identity, though, but I'm okay.
Your whole identity is everything you were. Now you're just a guy. You're just a guy writing for the New York Times. There's like a million of you.